This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've been an admirer of the work of actor and director and producer Griffin Dunne, who's best known for his role in Martin Scorsese's After Hours. But it wasn't until a few weeks ago that I realized Griffin Dunne was the son of Dominic Dunne, who was famous for writing about the famous. He wrote novels about the rich and famous and covered real celebrities and high-profile murder trials for Vanity Fair, including the trials of O.J. Simpson and Phil Spector. Murder trials became his obsession after his daughter, the actress Dominique Dunne, died after being strangled by her ex-boyfriend in 1982. She played the oldest daughter in the film Poltergeist. Dominic Dunne died last August at the age of 83. Griffin Dunne gave a funny and moving eulogy for his father. We're going to take this opportunity to talk with Griffin Dunne about his father, whose final novel has just been published posthumously. It's called Too Much Money. Griffin Dunne, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, very sorry
about your father and glad for the opportunity to talk with you about him.
Yeah, me too.
Do you usually read your father's novels?
From his first one, he has always printed it out and given me the loose leaf pages of every single one. And, you know, I have given him some real bum advice.
Really?
Oh yeah, because as a reader, his journalism is something that I'm just more sort of taken with, and his novels are particularly To Mrs. Grenville's and some afterwards. I remember reading People Like Us, and Tom Wolfe's book had just come out. And I said, Dad, oh my God, this is in the same terrain, and they're going to, you know, criticize you, and it's going to be, and you're taking on these people, and it's, everything I said couldn't have been more wrong. It was his biggest seller, and I worried him about nothing. So nonetheless, he still gave me his books. And with always a reminder, like, boy, you sure called it wrong on People Like Us. What do you think of this one?
One of the things that newspapers have picked up on in your father's novel, Too Much Money, is that the character in the novel admits that he's closeted and he's been celibate for almost 20 years. And he says, can't die with a secret. I'm nervous about the kids, even though they're middle-aged now. Not that they don't already know. I just never talk about it. And earlier this year, he described himself in an interview for the Times of London. He said, I call myself a closeted bisexual celibate.
It's a great phrase.
Yeah. That was not a revelation to you?
No. No, it was not, but it certainly was never a conversation, a family conversation either. I mean, I would say closeted celibate. He was as closeted in his heterosexuality as bisexuality and what am I missing there? Celibacy. The conversation itself was closeted. It wasn't the elephant in the room. It wasn't... quite honestly, you know, once you're, I guess I might have been, you know, all of us sort of were aware of it, but I think it, you get to a certain age where you don't particularly want to have the conversation anyway. It's never been, but I was very kind of touched, and I certainly have never seen him mention, reference his sexuality before. And it kind of put a smile on my face because I thought it's so typical of him to come out and then leave. and here I am,
answering the question,
being asked about answering the question. It's just perfect.
well, he says, I'm nervous about the kids, even though they're middle-aged men now. Did he have reason to be nervous about revealing this?
Of course,
as far
not.
As you were concerned.
Not. No, of course not. No, no. We always just sort of left it in his court if he was going to talk about it or not. And, it's something that the siblings would talk about, but never with him. I don't know. I don't feel a great loss in that aspect either way.
So when you say you knew, was it because you could just tell or because...
I think you kind of like get a vibe. He had a great friend who was also a great friend of my sister's, and I noticed that the when my sister was killed, that the friendship continued, that he just sort of went from being my sister's best friend to my father's best friend. Years and years later, when Dad was dying in Germany, he got an infection. I went to Germany to get him and bring him back to where he lived up, for another month or so. There was the friend who we hadn't seen. I don't think he'd mind me mentioning his name, but I haven't talked to him, so I won't. But obviously, when I arrived in Germany, there was Norman. I'll just say his name. He'd be fine. There was Norman, and I saw this incredibly close friendship. I think it had long since been celibate, I assume. But here he was, the only person that Dad felt comfortable enough asking him to come to this clinic to look after him. It was a stem cell clinic, and you had to go with someone. They wouldn't allow you to be a patient unaccompanied. So we called Norman, and Norman went there, and he was there looking after him. And I saw this history. I saw what affection and real history between these two men. And it was kind of for me like. For the week I was there, it was like getting to know a stepbrother I'd never met, even though I'd known Norman off and on over the years. This was real quality time that the three of us were having. And, I was really, it's one of the real kind of touching, grateful memories I have of Dad's last month.
So you're saying at one point you think Norman and your father had been lovers?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, sure.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Griffin Dunn. He's an actor, writer, producer, director, and his father is the late Dominic Dunn, who died in August and posthumously published as Dominic Dunn's new novel, Too Much Money. So we're using this as an opportunity to talk to Griffin Dunn about his father. You gave a beautiful eulogy for your father, which was actually published on the Daily Beast. And in that eulogy, you talked about how your father used to go to funerals years ago. Years ago, he used to go to funerals of mobsters and movie stars, and this was long before your father was famous. Why would he go to those funerals, and how would he get in?
Well, he was of course fascinated from such an early age by celebrity, by notoriety, by crimes. They had. He was of the generation of, as a little boy, it must have been the Lindbergh kidnapping to, then the Black Dahlia. And so crime and of course, movie stars and fan magazines were a huge part of his life. So when he moved to New York, it was really just by sheer geography that he lived a block or so away from Campbell Brothers Funeral Home, which is, where the place to be seen open casket that you'd be buried. And of course, everyone from Valentino to I think not Marilyn, but pretty much you get the idea. And of course the famous mobsters, that was the go-to place. And so when there is a viewing, particularly in those days, they didn't have velvet ropes or guest lists. They didn't presume you knew the person or didn't know the person. You could just wander in and go into their main viewing room and get in line and have a peek at Vinny the Chin or, there was one with, I think he went to, he went to so many of the, they weren't all just movie stars too. Sometimes they were, Clifton Webb was one. Was a great actor. Died somewhat obscurely, and there was hardly anybody there. And And the people that were there were very grateful that Dad and his great friend Mark Crowley were, even though they didn't know him, they were grateful for the company. So, you know, it was the beginning of his fascination with, well, I think it was the beginning of him kind of finding his voice, whether he knew it or not, of how he could use all of that kind of ridiculous voyeurism and actually find a voice as a writer.
Your father wrote about celebrities. He covered their trials, invited them to his parties, went to their parties. Being around celebrity was always important to him. Do you understand why it was?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that it was a part of him that, you know, was kind of... was really rooted in having a father who would not, his own father, who would not acknowledge him, who, you know, he was of four brothers and three sisters, and he was the outcast. He was the one that, you know, really did look at these fan magazines and, you know, was not interested in sports. And I think he had a real strong dream life of you know, going to the movies and, you know, imagining himself there. I think it's not a particularly untypical story of why so many people move to Hollywood or New York and become, you know, fame obsessed in a way. And I think he's one of those stories of like his family couldn't give him the security and glamour. He always wanted to be somewhere else, and it was on that screen. It was, you know, with those people and going to those parties and smoking those cigarettes and, you know, drinking those drinks and being at the Stork Club or wherever it is. I think he thought about that a lot, and that kind of drive and imagination will eventually lead you right to the Stork Club.
You know, you say he was an outcast in his own family when he was growing up. He said that his father used to call him a sissy and beat him.
Yeah. He's always said that. My Uncle John, who's younger than him, doesn't have a memory of that he could, just to show you how different their relationships were. Dad would tell a story about my grandfather was a doctor. He died before I was born. And he used to tell me the story of his father beating Nick with a belt and getting a phone call. You know, back in those days, the phone call was out in the hallway, and getting a phone call with the housekeeper saying, "Dr. Dunn, you're wanted on the phone at the hospital," and he's beating Dad, and he says, "Hang on one sec." And he goes and takes the call, speaks to, give him 2 cc's of, give some medical advice, instructions on the phone to the hospital, hangs up the phone, and then picks up the belt and goes right back on beating him. So it was like a, you know, that would have been a pretty traumatic thing for a kid. But it just seemed to be his relationship, very particular with just him, you know, him and his father. And I've always thought that had something so much to do with, him picking his fights with the, you know, taking on the bullies.
So since your father wanted to be around famous people and be, you know, get to the Stork Club, when he actually was around famous people and made his living from writing about those famous people and became famous himself, did he feel differently about fame when he became the object of it?
One, there wasn't a day in his life where he could not get over how famous he was. That he was recognized, that he was recognized by a cab driver. He'd literally, 20 years later, he'd go, "You're not going to believe this. This cab driver knew who I was." I go, "Really? You're that amazed by that?" And I can't believe it. Not a day goes by, Griffin. I cannot believe that I'm famous. I can't believe it. So it brought him, this is open enthusiasm, guileless, just joy. He loved it. And I used to keep a voicemail on my cell phone from a call. he used to leave incredibly long voicemails. And he called me from the chateau once. He goes, "Griffin, you're not going to believe this. I just took an elevator up with Bono. Did you know that Bono knows who I am? I can't believe my life. I can't believe my life. I just love it. I can't believe it. Bono, he knows who I am." It just put such a smile on my face every time. I just used to listen to it, you know? It just cracked
really
me up.
That's really great. So what did fame and celebrity mean to you growing up? Because you were surrounded by it off and on through your father.
And it sort of carries on. I grew up in Los Angeles and in New York, and ended up in the entertainment business. But my relationship to celebrity when I was young, in terms of dad, because before the, you know, I can't believe how great my life is chapter, before then it was in the 60s when I was growing up, where he was obsessed with getting the acceptance of celebrity and giving, you know, dinner parties just about every night. And his priorities were really to get here. It was confounding to me to this day still. He was a television executive, but would give parties for the greatest filmmakers and producers and actors of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. The people that were there, you know, as I became a film buff later on, I still can't get over the roster of directors and that were in his house. But at the time, I was just a kid who we would actually be bundled up in, you know, our bathrobe and pajamas and checked into a hotel if it was going to be a particularly rowdy party.
What do you mean by rowdy?
Well, you know, they partied. There was like, you know, there was drinking and dancing till dawn, and they'd go home and shower and then, you know, go to the studio the next day with a hangover. And so it was, we would have, their parties were real affairs, real, like, lots of drinking and, you know, people really let loose. You know, Dad used to document these photos, and you see these incredible encounters that he would have. I don't know why. Nobody seemed to bother that he had a camera. And he would take pictures of, like, fights and tears and then raucous, uproarious laughter. And they looked like a lot of fun. And they would all get dressed up. And, I mean, in those days, people put on tuxedos, you know, three nights a week. And hired, you know, orchestras to play in their living room and stuff. So, it was a swinging time. But he was at the mercy of these people he was entertaining. It was almost like if he couldn't, they weren't real unless, they liked him and came to his house. And then, you know, when it all went wrong for him financially and his marriage falling apart, all those people who ate all the food and drank the booze, they turned out to not be his friends. And he was a great venue for a great party, and he had great taste, and they were, you know, beautifully decorated, these parties. But as far as having real relationships with these people, these legends, they were pretty shallow at the end of the day, and everyone left him, and he was totally broke.
No, I read that your father was the stage manager early in his career of the Howdy Doody show.
Yeah.
Did that mean a lot to you?
Howdy was before my time.
It was before your time, okay.
But I certainly grew up knowing who he was. And he used to tell great stories, though, about what they would do before the show on the Howdy Doody show, you know, with the crew, of all the incredibly filthy things they would make Howdy do. and they would just cry with laughter at, you know, the compromising positions they do to right before, right up to the 10, 9, 8 before. So I have a different image of Howdy.
That's really funny. You write that your father was a man of exquisite taste who produced art and directed his life, but the storyline lacked the substance that your mother craved. And they were married for how many years before she left him?
Actually, 10. Only 10.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that his storyline lacked the substance that your mother craved, what do you mean?
Well, because he really, you know, he'd be the first to say this, is, you know, he became quite evolved out of this period. He was a very superficial guy. He really needed those parties, and who said what about him at the acceptance? He would literally iron the invitations that he received to other people's parties and events into a scrapbook. He wanted to live every moment as it was happening. Getting the acceptance of Selznick or someone like that that he went to this party, it's all he could talk about. And Mom was like, okay, what else is there? And, you know, she didn't want to go out. They went out like 5 nights a week. I think Mom just got sick of being dragged around. You know, she had health problems. And, you know, Dad was extremely driven. He really thought this was really important. It was a high, high priority. I think more than, I don't say this is a whiny kid, I think, but more than family. It was, you know, he's the first to say, you know, about those days, he really lost his way. He lost, and it cost him his marriage. There was never a moment he doubted how much he loved my mother. And I think one of the great, great regrets of his life is that the marriage fell apart. And the marriage fell apart because of, you know, his character at this time. It was not, it wasn't substantial enough.
Who did you stay with when they separated?
My mother.
Your mother?
My mother. Yeah, and you know, we had a funny reaction to when we were told about the divorce. Dad, you know, they'd obviously made the plan, and we were all like, I guess I was like 9 and 7, and my sister was 5, and my brother was 7, and they obviously planned, you know, let's not be hysterical when we say this, and we were seated on a couch, and Dad said, your mother and I have decided she wants to divorce me. And he totally changed the game plan. And I remember as a kid looking at my mom just rolling her eyes going, oh, God. And he was devastated, you know, crying, of course. And, you know, and he really could never get her back. And it wasn't until Mom became sick.
She had MS.
She had MS, yes, and was wheelchair bound. And, well, really, you know, when, I guess when my sister was killed is really when they got back in each other's lives and they really banded together. And he was with her, you know. Dad spent Christmases and Thanksgivings with us when my mother moved to Nogales, Arizona. And he became, you know, in our lives, as a father, while divorced, but as still the husband to my mom, you know, right up to the end from that moment. He was by her side. And I think it took her a while to get used to, quite honestly. But he was the one that could talk to her when she was really sick. You know, she was very, she was now by that point, you know, in bed, and the disease had given her it was difficult for her to talk. She could listen, but it kind of left it being a one-sided conversation. Dad loved that. He could talk and reminisce with her and, you know, do you remember the Starks and how we went to that house? Well, you know, they got rid of that house. Now they're moved over, and he would just go on, and she just loved listening to him. It was really poignant to see them.
After your mother left your father, he went through a period where he kind of spiraled downwards, and then I think he was like drinking and having problems. Mm-hmm. It got to the point where he had to sell everything. He even sold his dog.
Yeah.
And then he moved to New York and ended up living around the corner from you. You talk about this a little in the eulogy that you gave from him.
Yeah.
He ended up living around the corner from you in this like little Manhattan apartment that had a window that overlooked the air shaft, which was not exactly like the celebrity life he was dreaming of. But talk about what your relationship with him was like then.
Well, it was sort of my favorite period. I mean, it was he did indeed sell all of his stuff, and Norman and my sister helped him tag it. It was literally a yard sale, and this is a man who loved his objects, and that's also what I meant in the eulogy about art directing his life. He knows the provenance of everything he owns, and so it must have been incredibly painful for him to sell these, everything from fireplace banisters to incredible objects. And so then he moved to Oregon to write. His car sort of broke down there. And it was in there, in this cabin, that he forced himself to write. He had no phone. There was no way to reach him. And all the correspondence was by letters. And my letters that I would receive from him, by this time I had moved to New York and was starting out as an actor. The letters would, start off at 5 pages, and then a week later they go to 10, and then there'd be 20 single-spaced letters, page letters. And I realized that he was using them as like a workshop to write, to find his voice. And so when he came to New York, he'd been by this time maybe a year or two sober, and he'd been attending meetings, one a day, and kind of fine-tuning his material in the rooms, actually. And so when he came to New York and lived around the corner from me in the Village, we would have lunch, get together somewhere in the neighborhood. And, I was one of those kids who moved to New York to be in the Village and where James Dean was. And, I loved all these, kind of the street figures, and I kind of wanted to have a Damon Runyon-esque kind of relationship with the people on the streets. Which never quite happened, but, the boxer was like my kind of image coming to New York. Well, then all of a sudden Dad moves here, and we're sitting outside, a cafe or something, and all these street people I've always seen in the neighborhood would all go, "Hey, Nick," these Bukowski lookalikes and, cross-dressers and hairnets, they'd all come up and say hi to him. And I go, how do you know these people? And they go, "I know him from the rooms." And he was a star attraction in AA meetings. And it was like I just loved him.
A turning point in the life of your father and in the life of your whole family was the murder of your 22-year-old sister, Dominique, by her, ex-boyfriend, who wanted to continue being her boyfriend. He strangled her to the point where she was basically brain dead, and then the family had to decide, whether to pull the plug, and they decided to go ahead and do that. And then there was a long trial. Well, I don't know if it was long, but there was a trial afterwards. And it seems that that was a complete turning point in your father's life, like personally, professionally, emotionally, in every imaginable way.
Yeah. It was. It was, He was told by Tina Brown, who he'd just met before leaving for California for the trial, which was about a 3.5 month trial.
And this was Tina Brown right before she became the editor of Vanity Fair.
Exactly. I think she just had just, maybe it was the same week. I mean, literally, she'd only just hired Marie Brenner, and it couldn't have been newer. I don't think she'd published an issue yet. Anyway, she'd suggested to Dad that he keep a journal of this experience. And indeed he did, and ended up, writing about the trial that just nobody could have conveyed it, the outrage and the injustice and just how... what a travesty that whole experience was. Then Dad did, and he wrote this probably as as far as if you can put a critical thing on it, probably his greatest piece.
The man who killed your sister was convicted of manslaughter and given only 2.5 years, which I know your father considered a grave injustice. He was really angry, and one of the things, describe what happened when the judge said at the
well,
end.
Well, first of all, two and a half years. I am my father's son, because this is like the kind of stuff I actually don't, but I feel compelled to sort of continue for him about this, and because this was such a tough time. But he, this 2.5 years was really it was arrived at because this judge, his name is Judge Katz, and his career gratefully was ruined as a result of this, because of what Dad wrote about him. But this man sent away the jury while people were testifying. Women were testifying about his previous history of violence against women, which, by the way, my sister was completely unaware of. And they also, the jury did not witness this killer, Sweeney, get up to leave during this testimony that he didn't like of one of the women he tried to strangle a year or two earlier. And stormed out and was wrestled in a rage to the floor. So the jury missed all of that. So we saw him as he was. The jury somehow was portrayed like, you know, it was a different time too in justice when and women, the attitude of women's toward women's violence, women being victims of violence, and particularly in that time, you would portray the victim, that being the person that was killed, as being the perpetrator of their own crime. And so you'd basically trash the victim. You'd kill him twice. And so the way they talked about the defense, the way they talked about my sister, was just unspeakable. And then they sent away the jury, so they didn't even see what this guy was. So I don't know what the jury was thinking. I guess they thought, oh, the rich girl deserved it, or the poor guy with his prop Bible really believed in God, and now he's repentant, or, you know, whatever. But they gave this ridiculous ridiculous sentence, this insult, and to Dominique's life. And Dad, this judge said, at his closing argument, as his closing before adjourning, he said, "I want to thank the jury on behalf of the court, the defense, and the Dunn family." And Dad stood up in the courtroom and said, "Don't thank them on our behalf. We do not thank you." And information was suppressed. You did not see what took place here. You've made a grave mistake. And he was dragged out of that courtroom. And proudest moment, you know, for all of us. So, and it was then that he, that article, I think just all, I think he probably just wrote it pretty quickly after that and sent it off to Tina, and you know, that became his voice.
Were you in the courtroom every day of the trial too?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, they would, you know, my mother was in a wheelchair, and they would say to, the defense would try to have my mother removed because she was in a wheelchair, because, you know, it might prejudice the jury.
Wow.
Yeah, they would have, those conversations took place. For the jury. One time my brother was crying, and the defense, in the middle of his cross-examination, happened to see that Alex was crying. And he said, "Alex Dunn has tears in his eyes, Your Honor. He has to be ejected from the courtroom. That boy has tears in his eyes." You know, it was that kind of, you know, and it was really tough. And you know, my mother also came out of that experience transformed and angry and articulate, and started her group called California Center for Victims of Homicide, which is a very powerful group here that speaks on behalf of the victims, and has been responsible for a lot of legislation.
I want to end by asking you something about your father's funeral. You wrote a beautiful eulogy for him, which, you know, was published on the Daily Beast, And I'm just wondering what it was like for you to give that eulogy, because you're grieving. Your father has died. And at the same time, when you give a eulogy that's so well written and that has to be said in front of what I imagine was a large gathering of a lot of very famous people, it's almost like having a speaking engagement while you're grieving. So what was it like for you to have to rise to that particular occasion while mourning the loss of your father?
Well, my dad, this is sort of the running theme too of the funeral itself, which was an extraordinary event that my wife Anna and I sort of produced, for lack of a better word. My dad has been talking about his funeral for at least 10 years. He has been, whenever he got on planes, he would send me new revisions of who should speak, and who he's ever fallen out with is off the list, and who the pallbearer should be, and the ushers. And it was like and he'd have a sense of humor about it somewhat, but he was dead serious. And sometimes he'd have a rewrite that would happen in the middle of the night. He'd be in London, and he was staying at Claridge's. There was a little fire that happened, and he'd go, "I'm just running out the door right now. They're evacuating the hotel. If I don't make it out of here, I do not want so-and-so to be speaking at my funeral." So it was a you know, long time in the coming, and totally unjustified. He wasn't even sick when he was starting to think about this stuff. And I think that climactic, the most incredible moment that I ever had at a funeral, but the proudest moment I ever had as a father, was my daughter got up, and Hannah, and she always knew she was going to sing. She always knew that she wanted to sing a song, and it was a song called My Funny Valentine. And she wanted to explain to them that it was, you know, she'd always received anonymous flowers from my secret admirer ever since she was little, and she always knew it was from Poppy. And then she wanted to break into the song a cappella. And the church had heard she was going to sing a song, and they said, "No, it has to be a religious song. They don't allow secular songs." And I told my daughter, and she said, "No way, I'm getting up there. I don't care." I didn't raise her strict Catholic, so she goes, "I don't care what they do. They'll have to drag me off the stage. Those priests will have to just drag me off." And I said, "Honey, well, first of all, it's called an altar." And I said, "You can do this. I'm listening to you as a speaker, and just start to introduce, you know, talk about the flowers, and then play it as if you're overcome by emotion and you've got to sing. And you're last, so they can't drag you off." And I'm telling you, it was the most incredible moment. I mean, she's a great, great voice, but she just stood there, and her voice just, my God, it was incredible. And boy, Poppy could have heard it no matter where he was.
Griffin Dunn, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you. I really appreciate it a lot.
Thanks so much, Terry. Me too.
Griffin Dunn is a writer, producer, actor, and director who's currently developing a TV series based on Meg Wolitzer's novel, The Position. His father, Dominic Dunn, died in August of bladder cancer at the age of 83. Dominic Dunn's final novel has just been published. It's called Too Much Money. You can find a link to Griffin Dunn's eulogy for his father on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our critic at large, John Powers, has some recommendations for your holiday gift giving, movies and TV series on DVD.
When you watch as many movies and DVDs as I do, I'd be terrified to know exactly how many. It's only natural that people ask if I know of any good gift DVDs for the holidays. I always say that the best ones are seldom recent hits, which tend to have the life expectancy of mayflies. A good gift DVD should transport you into a different world that you can immerse yourself in over and over. That's why I begin by recommending Zeitgeist Films DVD of Topan, perhaps my favorite movie this year, which is set on the steppes of Kazakhstan. Now don't groan. This isn't some joyless documentary. It's the hilarious, vibrantly alive story of a young man returned from the sea who wants to marry a local girl, move into a yurt, and set up his own sheep farm on some of the most forbidding real estate on Earth. Brilliantly made by Sergei Dvortsevoy, Topan isn't just a beautiful, life-affirming tale, but a breathtaking portrait of human beings and their amazingly choreographed animals, with one foot in the present, the other in 2000 BC. You enter a very different world in my next recommendation, the box set of Foyle's War Series 1 to 5, From Dunkirk to VE Day. It's a British TV series about a police detective superintendent in the English town of Hastings during World War II. When I got it, I feared it would be corny old stuff, but these mystery stories instantly sucked me into their embattled mood. Foyle's War reveals things about wartime England I'd never seen before. The luxurious country hotels where rich Londoners went to escape the bombs that the poor could not. Or the secret military factories where they built all the coffins. What makes the whole thing irresistible is Michael Kitchen's enthralling performance as Foyle, who in his reticence, sly humor, and triumphant decency is our fantasy of the ideal Englishman. In contrast, my next choice is the purest Americana. It's the 70th anniversary Ultimate Collector's Edition of The Wizard of Oz, our greatest homegrown fairy tale, a fable about dreams and humbug, which insists that there's no place like home. Except that home is black and white, and Oz is Technicolor. Now, I know that you've seen the movie, but this is a package worth owning. It's got a gorgeous transfer of the film in DVD and Blu-ray, fantastic extras, including the fun earlier screen versions of Frank Baum's story, and even a commemorative green Wizard of Oz watch so nifty that I'm wearing it right now. It's telling me to speed things up, but not before we enjoy a few strains of our unofficial national anthem.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
At the end of the rainbow is this year's Pot of Gold, AK-100, Criterion's 25-disc collection of films by Akira Kurosawa, in honor of the centenary of the great Japanese director's birth early next year. It's simply a marvel. Not only does it offer four rare films never before on DVD, it contains disc after disc of classics by one of those filmmakers whose work isn't just great, which can often mean boring. It's as entertaining as the best of Hollywood. The world that Kurosawa transports us to is Japan, and I'm not sure any director has ever covered more aspects of any country's history. Kurosawa gives us rollicking samurai stories like Yojimbo and the Seven Samurai, and ravishing historical pageants like Kagamusha. He gives us action adventures like The Hidden Fortress, one of the inspirations for Star Wars, and a heartbreaking political drama like No Regrets for Our Youth, a masterpiece about the wife of an anti-fascist dissident. He does a Japanese version of Macbeth, but also puts a Tokyo spin on an Ed McBain crime novel in the riveting High and Low. He makes movies about women factory workers in World War II, about daily life in the slums in the 50s, and in one of his greatest films, Ikiru, he tells the tale of a dying bureaucrat who doesn't want to have lived meaninglessly. It ends with a shot in the snow that's one of the most haunting in movie history. AK-100 is an expensive gift. It's nearly $300 online. But it offers more than 50 hours of pleasure if you watch each film only once. And I'm betting you'll watch your favorites far more often than that. This isn't just a collection of discs. It's a box full of treasure.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue, and he writes the blog Absolute Powers for Vogue.com. Here's some other DVDs from this year that he recommends. Season 1 of the TV series Breaking Bad, about a dying chemistry teacher in the crystal meth business. The 1969 film Downhill Racer, starring Robert Redford. The silent film The General, starring Buster Keaton. The college football documentary Harvard Beats Yale, 29-29. The Swedish vampire film Let the Right One In. And the 30th anniversary edition of the Australian film My Brilliant Career. You'll find his complete list on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.